Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome everyone to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the province of Ontario has unveiled a new housing strategy, the Cutting Red Tape to Build More Homes Act. We'll dig into the details.
The Office of the Premier has 48 staffers on the Sunshine List. We'll talk about why that's a big deal.
The NDP had a banner year for donations, but Doug Ford is largely ignoring them. Why is he so focused on Bonnie Crombie?
And in your column, my column, we'll look at what the Ford government is and isn't counting as a home.
And I'm focused on the relationship between the country's two leading conservatives, Doug Ford and Pierre Poilievre, and why they are not BFFs.
It's Friday, April 12th, 2024, so let's get to it.
Can I start with a confession off the top?
If you must.
I must. I must start with a confession, which is, I so look forward to these weekly get-togethers because partly to talk politics with you and partly because I'm always curious to see what kind of sartorial splendor you will bring to the podcast. And you've been running with a space theme for the last many weeks in a row. And I show up today and you show up today and there's nothing. You're giving me nothing.
I went with a totally plain sweater. It was the top of the drawer and all of my whimsical t-shirts are in the laundry.
A complete lack of imagination on your part, if you don't mind my saying. I expect more.
Well,
I'm sorry.
You expect more. I think our viewers and listeners expect more. Well, maybe the listeners don't care too much about what I'm wearing, but the viewers expect more, and I will endeavor to do better.
I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to your fulfilling that commitment in the weeks ahead. I went with something very simple today.
Yes.
This is, right, opening week at the Sky Dome for the Blue Jays. So
absolutely.
I got a little thing with a Blue Jay logo on it. Seemed to make sense. I know it's a ratty old t-shirt with holes on it, but at least I'm consistent in pursuing a relevant theme, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, no, and I enjoy the Jays being back on the TV, and I wish they were winning more games lately, but it's still early in the season.
It's very early. Let's not get too excited. Okay, shall we?
Let's get to it.
On to issue one. Earlier this week, the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, Paul Calandra, tabled Bill 185. Here's the name of it. Get ready. Relax. It's called the Cutting Red Tape to Build More Homes Act, a mouthful of a bill that does what its name says and more. JMM, the details, if you please.
So this legislation, as you might have guessed by the cutting red tape, is intended to streamline things like permitting processes for new homes. The government is proposing to allow the construction of taller wood buildings. At the moment, particular types of wood buildings are limited to 12 stories in height. This would increase that limit to 18. It would eliminate parking requirements near major transit station areas, GO train stations, subways, that kind of thing. It also gives municipalities something that they have been clamoring for, the use it or lose it powers that they've been asking for. This is for cases where a developer has a building permit, has approval to start a construction, and importantly, has the sewer and water service allocated from that municipality, but has not actually put shovels in the ground. This would give the municipality power, the option to basically threaten to take that water servicing and give it to somebody who is perhaps closer to putting a shovel in the ground. Municipalities also won another big fight with the province. The Ford government is backing down on a number of changes that it had implemented previously on development charges. The government wanted development charge increases to be phased in, and they also wanted municipalities to be forced to refund development charges if a building permission wasn't given in a tight enough timeline. Both of those are being reversed, and municipalities had said that this could have potentially cost them millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. They have won that argument with the province.
I'm going to lay something on you now that I know will shock you. The opposition parties at Queen's Park were not thrilled with this bill. I know that was a surprise. Here's what the NDP leader, Marit Stiles, had to say. She said, again, the Conservatives are refusing to treat Ontario's housing crisis with the urgency it needs. The government continues to ignore top recommendations of its own housing affordability task force, including legalizing fourplexes and four-story multiplexes in all neighborhoods as of right. What's also missing? Real rent control and government investment in non-market housing, without which the housing affordability crisis will continue. The Liberals weighed in on this as well, the leader Bonnie Crombie tweeting, "Rather than legalizing gentle density, Paul Calandra introduced a random grab bag of small ball measures the Ford government could have done years ago if they were serious about building housing. This bill will not get the job done." What do you think of all that?
Well, it's not just the opposition parties at Queen's Park who are disappointed by this bill. You might think that the broader housing industry would be celebrating this week. This is a bill that's supposed to get more homes built. This is good for their business, presumably. The reaction, I would say, has been a bit more mixed than that. Certainly, some parts of the sector are excited, but the development sector is not a monolith. Some parts of this legislation could make it easier to build sprawl, what we call sprawl, greenfield development, or whatever you want to call it, new homes in places that are currently, you know, farmland, that kind of thing. But the Ontario Realtors put out a release the night of the government's announcement that was notable precisely because it really emphasized how much more they wanted to see from the government. The release uses language like "there is still work to be done" and adds that the Realtors are disappointed that core recommendations from the Housing Affordability Task Force report weren't included. The same kind of language we heard from opposition leaders at Queen's Park.
This is the Ontario Real Estate Association?
That's correct, yes.
Now, if memory serves, I think I know who the head of that association is. Would you care to refresh our viewers' memories?
The current head of the Realtors is former PC Party leader Tim Hudak, who I think it's fair to say did not expect to be on the same issue, on the same side of this issue as the Liberals, New Democrats, and Greens.
And I suspect the provincial government didn't expect to see Mr. Hudak on the same side as those parties either. We know the province has a target of building 1.5 million homes within the decade, and getting to that is proving to be very challenging, actually, within the decade, by 2031, I guess. So just outside of the decade. Whether they're going to get to that target, I guess, depends very much on what you permit as the definition of a home. And there's a great debate in the province of Ontario right now as to whether a home is a home or beyond that is a home. You want to help us understand this here?
Right. So Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister Paul Calandra has suggested the province is going to start adding student housing to its count of housing starts. This comes after the government has already included long-term care beds as part of its housing targets. This is relevant to this discussion of Bill 185 because Bill 185 will take the pretty substantial step of exempting public universities from the Planning Act. So if we're in Toronto, if the University of Toronto wants to build student housing, they will not have to ask the City of Toronto for zoning and planning permission to do it. Very big change in planning law, and we'll see how that actually unfolds because, you know, it's not like they exist in a universe separate from politics. They, you know, you could imagine MPPs might get an earful from universities across the province.
Yeah, on the other hand, it should encourage a lot of student dorm construction, that kind of thing.
That's certainly the intent and the hope. I think the idea that universities are going to dig us out of the housing crisis might be a bit of wishful thinking, but it is a notable change, and I think it will probably see more student housing built than less.
But you know what? This is what they say the theory is. You know,
yes.
if you can get more student housing built, then the students who are currently living in apartments or in houses, they will be able to leave those, freeing those up for the general population. They move to campus and everybody's theoretically happier.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a totally reasonable theory of the case. With the stipulation that the homes, the student housing that the universities build probably has to be more affordable than the rooms that students are renting right now, if you're going to draw them out.
Right.
And of course, universities aren't exactly flush with cash at the moment. Mm-hmm. So that's another issue. You know, but the government is pursuing this. They've made this change to the Planning Act, and they're also requiring universities to make housing commitments when they bring in particularly international students. We've talked a lot about that issue previously on the podcast. So we're going to see how this all unfolds. But, you know, I would say one of the points that a lot of the opposition parties made about this issue of what gets counted is, you know, nobody is arguing that student housing isn't a form of housing. The question is whether this is an honest accounting. And not to, to go over too much of the your column, my column bit, but I'm skeptical of that.
Well, I think we can say honorable people will disagree about whether or not student housing or long-term care beds count as homes and therefore should be included in the march to 1.5 million homes by 2031. So the debate will continue. This has been, I'm trying to think of a time when, I mean, if you think about the last couple of weeks, we have seen a lot of housing announcements by all three levels of government, frankly. The feds and the provinces have certainly been jockeying for position on this issue. Prime Minister Trudeau basically scooped as finance minister numerous times over the past couple of weeks, making big announcements about housing. He insists there is a lot more to come in the federal budget, which comes out April 16th, I believe. This is a full court press by the two senior most levels of government that feels different from the typical run-of-the-mill housing announcements. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you've got both a competition between the federal and provincial orders of government, and you've also got competition between the Liberal and Conservative parties over who is going to really own housing as an issue. And I would say the federal Liberals, I think it's fair to say they are a bit later to the game than they would like. I think Pierre Poilievre really owned the issue federally earlier, talking about, you know, how he was going to get gatekeepers out of the way of building new housing, that kind of thing. In theory, of course, Doug Ford also has a very strong political incentive because, you know, all of the polling I've seen suggests that this is one of his biggest vulnerabilities. This is one of the areas where people give him the lowest ranking is his handling of the housing issue.
Greenbelt might have had something to do with that.
Well, indeed, yes. But at the same time, we're also seeing, I think it's fair to say, we're seeing some pretty intense disagreements within the Conservative Party, within the Progressive Conservative Party provincially, about exactly how far to go on the housing issue. And indeed, you know, we've seen the Premier talk about, you know, if you allow four-story fourplexes everywhere, people are going to scream bloody murder. You know, that's a pretty hard limit on how far the Premier is willing to go.
Indeed. Okay, this bill with an interminably long name. Anything else we want to bring forward here?
I mean, I do want to tell our listeners and our viewers that there is a lot to it. It's a very big bill. These red tape reduction bills that the government is fond of tend to be omnibus bills that touch any number of areas. So we are really only covering the highlights here. But there is one I wanted to bring up. Hmm. You know that big EV battery plant that they're building in St. Thomas?
Is this the Volkswagen one?
Yes.
This is the one. It is going to be, when they finish it, the fourth largest building in the world, I think. Massive.
Yeah.
Yes.
And getting a hefty amount of both federal and provincial subsidies to build. One of the ways that Ontario was supporting that, aside from subsidies and some very interesting sort of legislative maneuvering that went on last year, they allowed the municipality of St. Thomas to waive things like development charges and property taxes. But they had to pass a special law to do that last year. They did it late in 2023. Bill 185 is going to give the cabinet, the premier and his cabinet, the power to do that more generally in cases where they think that it will be to the benefit of Ontario's economy. So in the same way that they have made this incentive available to this EV battery plant in St. Thomas, we could see many more cases of like that in the future, because of course that's not the only big manufacturing plant that the government is trying to woo to the province. They are really excited about the potential of the change in the auto industry to bring more manufacturing jobs and processing jobs broadly to Ontario.
Although with the announcement Ford made, not the premier, but the motor car company,
yes,
over the past week or so, saying they were holding off on rolling out that new line for what, till 2027 now.
I believe that's right.
That's a very large hiccup to the plans of the province to dive into the EV world, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, then you've got the issue of a lot of foreign automakers. I'm thinking in particular of the rise of Chinese and other Asian manufacturers who don't have a huge manufacturing footprint in Ontario, but are some of the most rapidly growing providers. I think it's a very interesting question right now. How quickly the industry is moving to EVs and who will be the primary beneficiaries of that, because it might not be the companies we've relied on most in Ontario, right? GM, Ford, Stellantis. They might not be the big winners in this you know, once in a century shift in the industry.
Indeed. Okay, on to issue two. Every year, the province of Ontario releases its Sunshine List, which shows how many public sector employees are making six-figure salaries. Full disclosure, I'm one of them. This was a policy that was brought in more than 25 years ago by the Mike Harris government. This time, people took notice of one office in particular. And what office would that be, JMA?
That would be the office of the Premier, Doug Ford's own staff.
I believe that's right. The office has 48 staff members, apparently, on the Sunshine List. And those staffers make almost $7 million in annual salaries. Now, in a provincial budget of $215 billion a year, $6.9 million is not a heck of a lot of money. But you compare that to back in 2019, Doug Ford's, I guess, second year in power, and that office cost $2.9 million. $6.9 today, $2.9 back then. And things got a little heated at Queen's Park over those numbers. Take a look.
The gravy train has pulled in to the Premier's office, and friends, insiders, fat cats, well, they all get a free ride. Is the Premier so out of touch, Speaker, that he thought it was a good idea to raise his office budget by more than $4 million and that each of his 48 staff make more than the median Ontario family?
Speaker, when they're in office, they increase taxes 45 times. Billions of dollars, chase 300,000 jobs out of the office. Compared to us, Mr. Speaker, we have never raised a tax.
Okay, there's John Fraser, the parliamentary leader for the Ontario Liberals, and then, of course, Doug Ford responding. You heard him say the gravy train. That, now, that's them's fighting words in the Ford family, because, of course, that harkens back to the Premier's brother, Rob Ford, who used that slogan very effectively. We're going to stop the gravy train on way to becoming the mayor of Toronto. You heard the Premier say, we've never raised a tax while we've been in power, and that is certainly his response to a lot of things these days. But let's dive down. First of all, which employees in the Premier's office are we talking about here?
So the Premier's office is the political, partisan political staff who work around the Premier, particularly on communications and policy development. They are not the Ontario Public Service, right? There's a separate office, cabinet office, that is the high-ranking public servants who advise the Premier in that capacity. But what we're talking about are the office of the Premier. They are partisan staff. They are hired and fired really solely at the discretion of the Premier or his chief of staff. They don't have, you know, civil service protections. They work at the pleasure of the Premier.
Hmm. Now, what is the consistency here in being a conservative in favor of smaller government, and yet having a Premier's office staff that is bigger than ever and cost more than ever?
Well, you know, I guess the Premier would say that they are still delivering for the broad priorities of keeping taxes low. They probably can't say that they're keeping spending low, as the budget is as large as it's ever been in Ontario. But, you know, this the Premier's office's role is to, as we say, to advise the Premier, to help develop policy. Partisan staff can do things that the civil service cannot. We also can remember some of the events of the last year plus, you know, the Greenbelt scandal, the ongoing housing crisis we've already talked quite a bit about. You can imagine that there are reasons why the Premier might want to bring in new advisors and people to help better shape some of its messaging and some of its marketing efforts. You know, there is a not exactly a revolving door, but there are people who move out of public service, and then, you know, they go work in a consulting firm or whatever for a few years, and then they can come back into public service when the time is right, when they are called upon by the Premier of the day.
Mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing, JMM, is you never know what's going to tick off the electorate, right? I mean, sometimes you hear these, you know, billions of dollars for this and billions for that, and that doesn't cause a ripple. And then you find out some cabinet minister ordered a $16 glass of orange juice, and that makes people extremely upset. So, you know, as I say, on a $215 billion budget, almost $7 million for Premier's office salaries is not a lot. But people understand what $7 million is, and who knows, this could become a thing.
Yeah, and I think the issue that governments worry about a lot is the stuff that is brand poison. And I think of some of the scandals that Justin Trudeau got involved in before the 2019 election, you know, things like the SNC-Lavalin issue. Quite aside from the specifics of any one of these scandals, it's the way it changes how people see you. And, you know, they might have been willing to cut you a break on stuff previously, but the way the scandal changes how public see you, suddenly they no longer cut you a break, even on the small stuff.
Exactly. And I should clarify, just on behalf of the Ford people, the $16 glass of orange juice is not one of Ford's ministers.
No.
That was a Stephen Harper cabinet minister probably, it's more than a decade ago now. Anyway, okay, so what else here? Anything else?
Well, there is data that shows that the historically, the premier's office budget goes up around election years. We've talked about the communications role for the premier's office, and this is explains some of that. You tend to hire more communications people as you're going into an election year. We are not in an election year right now, but we will be heading into one, you know, in the next 18 months, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a good chance that we could see these costs in the premier's office go up further. It would be difficult to imagine a future in which Doug Ford would go without the help that he could have available to him.
Indeed. Now, while we're on the issue of money, we thought we should point out that the Ontario New Democratic Party is feeling pretty good about the way things are going right now. Since Maurette Stiles became the leader of the party a little over a year ago, the party has raised $5 million through its fundraising efforts, and the party says it also broke a fundraising record in the first quarter of this year. All of that to say, the NDP is building a good-sized war chest. For the first time ever, they are the official opposition for two elections in a row. Unlike the Liberals and the Greens, they are a recognized party at Queen's Park, right? You've got to have 12 seats to be an officially recognized party. They've certainly done better than 12 for two consecutive elections. But here's the question. If all of that is true, and it is true, why is Premier Ford so focused not on them, but on Bonnie Crombie and the Liberals? Crombie doesn't have a seat. The Liberals aren't an official party. And yet Ford seems very focused on her and her party.
We've seen this repeatedly during the Premier's press conferences and some of their ad spending. They are really focused on Bonnie Crombie and the Ontario Liberal Party, and are all but ignoring Maurette Stiles and the New Democrats outside of question period, I guess. We can speculate, I think, a little bit about this. I think based on the evidence, you could say that Ford and his advisors, those people in the Premier's office, have decided that the NDP are not going to be their primary opponents in 2026. They believe, rightly or wrongly, and they could be wrong about this, right, that it is going to be just a Ford-Crombie slugfest, and that Maurette Stiles will not be the primary threat to Ford continuing in government.
Mm. There's lots of ways of keeping score in politics. One is, of course, public opinion polling. And right now it shows Ford and the Conservatives well out in front in first place, the Liberals and Crombie in second, the NDP and Stiles in third. But another way to keep score is fundraising. And if you're bringing money in, that's usually an indication that you got something good going on out there. Anyway, that's just that's the history of this.
And we should say that the Ontario Liberals also had a pretty decent year last year between their leadership race and the momentum they carried after Crombie won. They raised something like $1 million before the year ended in 2023. So, you know, they would obviously hope to keep that money train rolling.
Now, this might be a good time to drop in a little listener mail from a woman named Deb Sonego. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, Deb. Deb is the Kanata-Carleton NDP Provincial Riding President. And she wanted to follow up on something that we talked about last week on the, as it was related to the by-election in Kanata-Carleton back in July of last year, which that was a former Conservative seat, which the Liberals took from the Conservatives. So that was a bit of a, well, that was a heck of an upset. Sheldon, let's bring this up here. We canvassed, this is Deb talking, we canvassed the urban part of our riding twice, either in person or by phone. The golf course was mentioned in Kanata North, but was not an issue anywhere else. That was a local irritant, which caused some consternation for the Tory candidate. Housing and lack of a family doctor were the two biggest concerns. I told the party 1 year before our by-election that the riding was going progressive due to the number of young families moving into our riding. My prediction was true, and our canvassing had us leading the Liberals on the day before the election. But many of our voters went Liberal at the last moment as they were afraid of a Conservative win. That's from Deb Sonego, Kanata-Carleton NDP Provincial Riding President. Comments?
Well, I went back and I looked at the actual vote counts for that by-election, and it turned out there was fewer than 2,000 votes separating the Liberal and the New Democrat in first and third place, respectively. The Tory came in second there. So Deb's accounting of events there could be right. You know, by-elections are funny that way. It was a bit of a lower turnout. I think it was 35%-ish, which is low by the standards of a general election, but is a totally reasonable amount for a by-election. I do want to put a spotlight, though, on the housing issue that Deb mentioned, because if it was a big deal in Kanata-Carlton last July, I really strongly suspect it will be at least as relevant in Milton on May 2nd.
I think you are right about that. And with that, let's get to our columns. Time now for our regular feature, Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I reminisce about the columns we wrote for TVO.org over the past week. What have you got teed up for us today?
So as I mentioned earlier, both of my columns this week were about the housing issue. And I did want to talk about this question of how we count things like student housing or retirement homes or long-term care beds, because I do think it is genuinely concerning that the government is watering down its housing targets by counting more and different types of residences. As we say, it's not that student housing isn't a home or even that student housing doesn't play a direct role in increasing the availability of other homes. But that 1.5 million target was set without counting student housing or retirement homes or long-term care beds. So if we're going to start adding to the numerator, we need to start changing the denominator for people who remember their middle school math.
You promised me there'd be no math on this.
I'm sorry, journalists and math, it's a thing. But then there's the other issue that 1.5 million number is already out of date. If you talk to somebody like economist Mike Moffitt, he says Ontario probably needs something more like 1.7 million now because the rates of immigration in the last few years have increased housing demand so much. So, you know, targets are important. I think targets, especially like a clear numerical target, can be really useful in focusing a government on policy outcomes. But you got to stick to your targets and you can't just water it down it's a point of concern.
Okay, very good.
And how about yourself?
I have been increasingly interested over the past many months in the relationship between the two most, I would say, best known, most influential conservative political leaders in the country. And of course, I'm talking Premier Doug Ford and the leader of the Conservative Party federally, Pierre Poilievre. They would seem to have so much in common, right? They're both in first place in their respective polling. They're both popular at the moment. Both conservatives, obviously. Both populist conservatives, I think it's fair to say. Their support bases are also quite similar. I suspect there's a great deal of overlap there. But I don't know about you. I keep hearing, the more I talk to people around Queen's Park, and federally for that matter, that these two don't like each other, that they don't get along. I hear this all the time. So Pierre Poilievre was having... He had a little announcement that he wanted to make in Mississauga last Sunday. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go check that out and see if I can sneak a question in here. And I simply asked him, what's your relationship like with Doug Ford? Pretty neutral, open-ended, lean question. And here's what he had to say. Roll it, please.
Thank you. Next question. Steve from TVO. Hi, Pierre. Hi. Could you describe your relationship with Doug Ford?
He's the premier. I'm the leader of the federal opposition and the next Prime Minister of Canada. And my relationship with him is the same as with everyone. I will work with anyone to axe the tax, build the homes, fix the budget, and stop the crime. Thank you.
And that was it. And according to the rules of the Poilievre Q&A, you don't get a follow-up.
Ah.
You get one question and you're out. Premier Ford, I'll say for the record, one question plus a follow-up. No follow-ups here, so I couldn't go on beyond that. I found that answer quite interesting, partly for what it said. I regard him like I regard anybody else. That's an unusual thing to say about the kind of the most powerful conservative politician in the country today. But I also found interesting what he didn't say. He didn't say, oh, my friend Doug or my friend the premier, didn't call him my friend. And every politician calls every other politician my friend. They do that all the time. Even when they're not friends, they call each other friends.
Doug Ford sounds friendlier about Justin Trudeau than Pierre Poilievre sounds about Doug Ford.
You're absolutely right. Right. They seem to have so many common interests. They certainly have a common interest in defeating liberals. There was nothing about that. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, boy, there are a lot of irritants between these two guys right now. Parm Gill, you could start right there, right? This was a former Ford cabinet minister who quit the provincial government in order to run federally in the Milton area in the next federal election for Poilievre. I don't think the Ford people at Queen's Park are happy about the federal party poaching on their popular politicians. There's also this notion of alternation. And, you know, can I guarantee this? No, of course not. But if you look back through the history of the province of Ontario, it almost always happens that when there are conservatives in power federally, there aren't provincially. And if Pierre Poilievre wins the next federal election, you know that changes the dynamic at Queen's Park in a way that Doug Ford won't like. One last thing on this. A very experienced conservative saw my column, and he sent me this possible explanation. And it has to do with Jenny Byrne, who once worked in Doug Ford's premier's office, and then she didn't. So she went back to Ottawa, and she is now running Pierre Poilievre's operation. And this person's email simply said, "Ford fired Jenny. Jenny gets revenge. That's it." That was the whole email. I think he may have said in 8 words what it took me 800 to say. But anyway, there you go.
You know, I have periodically joked that, you know, people underestimate how much of Canadian politics just boils down to grudges. And I don't think that's 100% of what's going on here, but it's never zero either. I mean, one other thing that I comes to mind, and I'm not sure how much I believe this, but, you know, one really obvious dividing line between Poilievre and Ford is the response to COVID. Right. Mm-hmm. Ford was premier during the pandemic and had to implement a bunch of public health measures that I think we can fairly say they are still controversial in some sense. And Poilievre, of course, opposed a lot of those measures federally when Justin Trudeau was imposing them on things like air flights and trains and that kind of thing. So there is actually a dividing line that's more than just the personalities involved as well.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. Now, can I also just take advantage of this opportunity to follow up on a column that I wrote last week that we talked about, which was this sort of tent city that had cropped up at City Hall Square in Hamilton. And I was back in Hamilton last weekend and went to the top of a nearby building near City Hall. It looks to me like about half the tents have left. I'm not sure where the people have gone. I'm not sure. I don't think they were forced out. Like, I don't think the police came by and cleaned the place out.
It wasn't a clearance.
No. But I think there was some encouragement by city officials to reduce the homeless population in City Hall Square. And therefore, there are fewer tents there this week than last week. But of course, where did they go? Where did the people go? I'm sure they're still homeless. I'm sure they didn't suddenly buy homes. So anyway, this has all just raised a lot more questions for me, and I'm still curious about what's going on there.
And with that, we are going to go to the mailbag.
Excellent. Before we get to the mailbag, I want to do a shout out because I was in Ottawa last week for a shoot on Parliament Hill. And as I'm in the train station on the way back to Toronto, a young woman comes up to me and says, "Hey, you and McGrath, love that podcast. I listen to the podcast all the time." Her name was Geneva Neal. Is that a great name?
That's a great name.
Geneva Neal. So the thing I found interesting about this is, you know, the agenda, we're in season 18 for the agenda. And we are in like season one for televising this podcast.
Yeah. Like episode 5 or something.
Right. Yes. I think I have as many people coming up to me now saying, "Love the podcast, Steve. Love watching it on TV," as I do people making comments about other things they say on the agenda. So all of which is to say, I'm thrilled that we're televising this on Friday nights because it seems to be giving us a whole new audience, which is great.
Before we started rolling, I mentioned that the people saw me at Queen's Park. And I've been a Queen's Park reporter for a decade. And, I walk around with my pass and, it's fine. I'm not like begging to be noticed or anything. But this week, walking around the halls of Queen's Park, staff was like, "Oh, hey, I saw you on the show." Yeah, you did.
Yeah. Being on TV is different. Okay, if you've got a burning or insightful question or comment, we want to hear it. Send it to onpolitics@tvo.org and JMM, open up the mailbag and start us off this week.
All right, here is an email from listener Gianni Corini who writes, "Great show, guys. Why is it that the issue of free transit for Toronto never gets discussed? Mm. It would cut back circulation by cars and other private transport. Funding would come out of taxpayers anyway, and it would improve the lives of everybody. It would be the best city in the world. Respectfully, Gianni."
I have a theory. You want to hear my theory?
Sure do.
Whether you don't, you're getting it anyway. But I have a theory on why transit is not free, and it's because I think there are two schools of thought on this issue. Number one, transit is an entitlement, in which case it should be free. Or number two, transit is a service, in which case you have to pay for a service. And ever since the Toronto Transit Commission, the Hamilton Street Railway, OC Transpo, all of the transit services in this province were created, the transit is a service that you need to pay for thinking has dominated. And that's why it's not free, Johnny. I'm sure everybody would love it if it were free, But the fact is it isn't, because people don't see it as an entitlement. At least the decision makers don't. They see it as something you have to pay for because it's a service.
And some of this stuff is historically contingent, right? Back in the 1800s, when these transit services were getting started in big cities, including what became the TTC, these were actually privately run for-profit companies. So, of course, they charged a fare. And then with the rise of automobiles, it became less profitable for these to run as going, you know, private enterprise. So they got taken over by the government. But that initial setup of having fares cover most of the bill never went away. And in the case of the TTC, it had one of, in the industry, they call it the fare box recovery ratio, mm-hmm. how much of the operations are paid for by fares. And the TTC had one of the highest ratios in North America. You know, it varies widely all over Ontario. Go Transit, this has been a point of some grumbling in Toronto. Go Transit, for example, has always gotten more generous subsidies from the provincial government, while the TTC has had to sort of beg and scrape for every spare nickel.
And the UP Express, the UP Express from Pearson Airport to Union Station, also heavily subsidized, heavily. But the TTC, not so much. Okay, go on. You got another one there?
Yes, we received a very nice note over on Blue Sky, a different social media site where we are putting a bit more of our efforts in from TVO. Listener Jane Cote writes, "I think there's nothing like you anywhere in any medium. Your quality is so high, it's kind of almost too high for me. Congratulations on your excellent work." Thank you very much, Jane. I guess we have to work on lowering our quality?
No, I don't think that's what she means. I don't think she means. Although I do think I see a future slogan for our show here.
All right.
The quality is high, but we aren't. I think we can go with that. Yeah, I think the poor folks at the Ontario Cannabis Store would go broke if they had to rely on us as customers.
I am not a regular customer there, I will say. Again, if you'd like to ask about our content on the show, or I guess any extracurriculars, please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org.
There we go. That is the On Poly podcast for this April 12th, 2024.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And you can see the video version of the podcast on the TVO Today YouTube channel.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org and be sure to include your first and last name and where you're calling from.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara, video editing by Colin Kish.
Production support from Jonathan Hallowell, Christine Gardner, Vito Tagarelli, Jeff Cassera, and Jennifer DeRosa.
Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor. Lori Few is the executive producer of digital. John Ferry is vice president of programming and content.
Special thanks, as always, to our studio crew here for making this show look so darn good. Thanks, guys. And until next Friday, shall we say bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.